This week on Making Contact.
Young people are coming out. They're coming out in the context of school. They're coming out to their parents, to a grandparent.
Young people today are embracing a wide range of terms to describe their sexuality. Straight, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, two-spirit, pansexual, down-low, questioning, along with reclaiming formally pejorative terms like dyke and queer. They're changing the way that society thinks about sexual orientation and gender identity. On this edition, a collaboration with KPFA's Full Circle program, we'll examine how queer youth identity intersects or collides with racial identity. We'll also take a look at the fluidity of identity from labels to families. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. In a nation that boils identity down to checkboxes on a census form, what happens to young people whose realities are more complex? Queer youth of color across the nation often find themselves at the crossroads of identity politics and community loyalties. For those who turn to youth organizing as both a way to find support and make a difference, which community do they prioritize when they decide to become activists? Correspondent Kristen Zimmerman reports.
Yu Tong had just finished second grade when he immigrated from China to the United States. At 8, he was already discovering that even though he was born female, he identified as male. Growing up in Atlanta, Georgia's Chinese immigrant community, Tong had to straddle his self-discovery with the challenges of being an immigrant.
Most of my blood family are still in China, and so like they have not seen me grow at all. And then it's like being first generation, like my parents is like hell of struggling, like trying to come up basically and trying to maintain, like make sure that we have food to eat, shelter, you know, like just the bare essentials, you know. So it's like, you know, it's interesting being first generation because it's like they're while you're growing up and trying to learn about life, they're pretty much doing the same thing because this is like a completely different culture. You know, like to grow up in a world and then come to another world and having to survive is a very hard process, and it's a pretty violent process.
As a female-bodied person, Tone was expected to step in line with his community's traditional gender roles. When he hit puberty, he felt intense pressure to act and look feminine. In the end, Tone said he needed to leave his community in order to find himself.
If I was still living under my parents, I would not have had the space or even the resources to like really explore into myself. And I felt like being in school and kind of just being on my own forced me to really have to be pushing myself and like trying to understand what it all means for myself.
In college, Tone found a community of genderqueer youth who became like a family to him and helped him become more comfortable with his transgender identity. For most youth like Tone, leaving one's birth community and adopting a new family comes at a cost. Over the years, Tone lost much of his first language and with it the connection to his parents. At each step of the way, he had to decide what parts of himself he was willing to fight for and what he was willing to sacrifice. Many queer youth of color are forced to choose between communities that focus on only part of their identity. And Tanya Lee, Youth Development Director at Coleman Advocates for Children and Youth, said she has seen this dynamic in community organizations focusing primarily on race and class issues.
Even if, you know, we do work around homophobia and training around anti-oppression work, the culture is not often a safe culture for queer youth to be in. And even if it's maybe technically safe, it's not an affirming or empowering space for them often. And obviously they seek out queer spaces. And the problem there is that many of the queer spaces are largely social services, which meet many of their needs. It's not that that doesn't, you know, that meets some many of their social needs, sometimes their academic support and advocacy needs, but it doesn't meet their needs to play clear, visible leadership roles in their community around basic, you know, institutional racism and economic injustices, because those places aren't focused around organizing.
By not addressing the whole experience of queer youth of color, organizations can contribute to feelings of marginalization.
You know, when we're teaching young people about who has power in our society, you know, how they should think about who are their allies, coalitions, all that kind of stuff, it doesn't often get meaningfully integrated into the politics of the work. And so it's another form of sort of political invisibility.
These themes of invisibility and marginalization also resonated in Jose Ramirez's life. Ramirez grew up in the Southern Bible Belt. As the first son in a highly traditional Latino family, he was expected to be manly, get married, and have children.
My father, actually, at the time when I came out, I was living in Fairfax, Virginia with my father, and I came out to him first, and I had an iron thrown at me, and he told me to get the hell out of his house. I came back from school. All my stuff was in bags, and that's when I came down here to North Carolina. And it was hard for my mom also, but she was like, you know, you're my mijo, so I gotta, you know, take care of you, and I guess I have to learn to accept you.
Once in North Carolina, Jose began searching for a new home and community of support. He soon found a center in Durham for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered youth. Hoping for a refuge, he instead found alienation. The center did not address race or class issues explicitly, and most of the youth who hung out there were white and upper middle class.
It was hard because I went in and I was the only person of color, Latino, there. And like I said, their issues were so much different from mine. Like, people were crying about, well, I came out to my parents, I'm not going to get a car, you know. I was like, no, I can't relate to that because, first of all, I'm too damn broke. And my parents are too broke to even think about buying me a car, you know. Like, I had to worry about, like, what I was going to put in my mouth the next day or where I was going to sleep or was I going to get jumped by somebody or stuff like that.
Jose left realizing he needed to find a place where he could integrate his identities. As a newly homeless, HIV-positive young man, he was just looking for some support and friends. Then one day, he decided to go to Incline, the North Carolina Lambda Youth Network. Over a third of the youth who go to Incline are homeless. The 16 young people in Incline's support group, mostly youth of color, were struggling with similar issues. At the time, Jose did not identify as an activist, but this space gave him the community he was looking for and sparked a long-buried passion for learning and organizing.
I just felt right at place, and then I started doing work around HIV and AIDS and looking at that, and then I joined the People of Color Caucus here and looking at racism and, like, immigrant issues and stuff like that. And eventually I was put in a leadership position, and I started caring more about myself and caring about, you know, continuing to educate other young people about different stuff that were going on in the community.
Now, 6 years later, as Incline's health education coordinator, Ramirez has learned to organize campaigns, create petitions, and lobby decision makers. Youth in Incline organize around many issues, including juvenile justice, education, and military recruitment. However, Ramirez says that Incline, because of its queer identity, does not always get the recognition it deserves from other racial justice organizers. Lee, of Coleman Advocates for Children and Youth, says without groups like Incline, queer youth often leave youth organizing.
That had a direct impact not only on them, but on the rest of the group who are now missing a queer young person of color to help them see what does this work look like through the lens of a queer young person? What does it look like to be fighting for, you know, better schools and more jobs for young people and a better juvenile justice system from the eyes of a queer young person? And we're missing that analysis when those young people aren't there.
Some youth organizers have found a way to integrate their worlds. Kohei Ishihara, who is a biracial Japanese American, was a college student in Providence, Rhode Island, when he and a group of friends started the Providence Youth Student Movement, or PRISM.
Lead organizers of PRISM started it off as a racial justice community organizing group, but almost all of us were queer, and we're all very sensitive to queer issues. So basically, you know, all the youth who became involved in PRISM, they saw that we were gay, and the gay youth, or the youth who were in the closet, they stayed. They saw this very supportive environment.
One of these friends was a gay Cambodian man who grew up in the local community in what's called the 0.5 generation, referring to an influx of youth in the 1980s who grew up half in the refugee camps of Thailand and the Philippines and half in the United States cities.
That means they were the first teenagers in America's high schools. They were the first teenagers in America's public housing complexes. They're the first Cambodian teenagers on America's streets. So all of a sudden, you have all these new Southeast Asian youth in America who don't speak English, who look and act different.
In order to survive their new environment, many of these youth formed gangs to protect themselves, and many got caught up in the criminal justice system. PRISM started organizing the community to deal with this crisis. Soon they discovered that the problem was much bigger than they had realized. With new immigration policies implemented after September 11, 2001, convicted youth were facing deportation. However, PRISM was different than other youth organizing efforts, and this created a powerful new dynamic in the community.
All of a sudden, we have all these queer Southeast Asian youth organizing a deportation campaign. So you have all these femme flamboyant Cambodian Laotian Hmong men and a few Cambodian Laotian queer women and straight women knocking on doors or going to gang meetings or gang parties or gang barbecues where there's all these hardcore straight thugs and basically being like, "Hi, how can we help you? We're here trying to save you. We're here trying to help you fight your deportation."
No one expected the community's formerly closeted gay youth would be the leaders to address the community's crisis. Interestingly, through this process, PRISM also created a space for young queer Southeast Asians to come out while maintaining their cultural identity and community ties.
So this amazing camaraderie among Southeast Asian youth who could all of a sudden not just be open about their sexuality, but actually open about their sexuality through their own languages, through their own customs, through their own experience. And it was amazing for this bonding to happen in the context of activism, in the context of changing your community. Not running away from your community to become gay, but staying in your community and helping your community and creating a space where you can be supported.
The leaders of PRISM were inspired by this experience. Seeing the strength and power of this community, they focused PRISM on both racial justice and queer youth organizing. Kohei says this is the key to organizing a widespread multiracial youth movement where queer youth activists can find a home. For Making Contact, I'm Kristen Zimmerman.
We'll have more about queer youth identity in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Homosexual identity has come a long way since the 1930s.
We talked about ourselves as being that way. Sometimes we're known as being nervous. I love that. Well, he's nervous.
Harry Hay, who died in 2002, spoke in a 1990 film interview about being gay before the term was used outside of the penal code.
We didn't use the word gay yet. We didn't use the word homosexual yet either. You know why we didn't use homosexual? It wasn't in the dictionary yet. And this is something most people don't recognize. We didn't have words for ourselves because they're not in the dictionary and they're not available. They would be known in university circles in certain abstractions. They would be in the penal code, but not too many of us read the penal code. And it doesn't get into the American dictionaries until just before the Second World War. And it was in the Webster, and the American dictionary wasn't there till about 1954. And then only as an adjective, not as a noun. As an adjective, and you have to recognize that what is being talked about this time is there are heterosexuals who have gone perverted. There are heterosexuals who have become degenerate. And they perform these nasty acts on Saturday nights behind the bushes in the park. And that's a homosexual act, and it's illegal. And if you got caught the first time, you get 6 months in the county jail. If you got caught the second time, you get sent to a Atascadero, which was the state prison. And in the state prison, you were offered a choice, two choices of cure. One is castration and the other one's lobotomy. And don't think we don't know thousands of guys who went that road. We did in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, of people who had been that mutilated by the state. And that was your choice. So therefore, you're dealing with people, and we are still heterosexuals who have become perverted or degenerate. Either one of those two, and this is the word you know about yourself. This is what you hear about in the daytime, on the radio, you didn't have TV then, but on the radio, but all the newspapers are always talking about that. And if they catch you in any kind of a raid along the line, your name and address appears in the paper. If your name address appears in the paper, you lost your job. If you had financing for a car, you lost your financing. You could lose your lodging. You just got wiped out.
Amazing.
Totally wiped out. So that you're dealing with a form of terror that you guys have no idea about now. And this, we left in it every day. And more importantly than that, we were not even concerned with that. Every day you were concerned with the fact that you were surrounded by blackmailers on either side who would turn you into the cops, who would turn you into the newspapers, unless you paid up. And I would say half the people that I knew who had jobs paid regularly on their blackmail.
In the early 1950s, Hay helped found the Mattachine Society, which started as a way to organize gays as a cultural minority through education and protest, a novel concept for its time. While oppression against homosexuals is still present today, the social landscape is much different. Correspondent Noah Miller has this report on how the youth today define themselves.
Approaching outbound two-car Castro shuttle, followed by...
The Castro District is San Francisco's gay ghetto. It's just a short subway ride from downtown. Right in the middle of the Castro is a three-story purple Victorian house, Lyric, the Lavender Youth Recreation and Information Center. It's one of the largest local organizations in the country serving non-straight youth. What you'll discover inside, right away, is that there's no easy answer to the question, what does it mean to be young and gay? You will find lots of young people willing to discuss it. Viviana is 14 years old. She says she identifies more with the words lesbian and queer. I asked her what queer means to her.
Well, queer just means you're in the spectrum of being either LGBTQI.
Isn't that a derogatory term? Isn't that like a slur?
Well, you know, some people think dyke is a derogatory term.
Would you call yourself a dyke?
I mean... Once in a while, it's kind of, you know, whatever, it's funny, man. And some people, well, faggot's a derogatory term, and gays still mess around with their friends and use that term.
But the most surprising thing that you'll find here among the youth at Lyric is the blasé attitude some of them have about all these descriptors.
I mean, dang, if you have to label yourself, why can't you just change the label once in a while if you're going to have to label yourself? I mean... Out with the old, in with the new.
Several blocks away from the gay Castro district is the largely Latino Mission District and the offices of the Family Acceptance Project. Caitlin Ryan is the San Francisco State University researcher directing the project. She and her team are interviewing young Californians who identify themselves as lesbian, gay, or bisexual, and their families. She says youth are discovering same-gender attractions earlier and earlier, on average at age 10.
When I say that youth who have same-sex attractions become aware of those attractions at around age 10, the same thing is happening for heterosexual young people. And so I think it would be a mistake to think that gay youth are sexually precocious or they're different than adolescents in general. They're really not. There are many, many ways that young people can learn about their sexual identity or even their gender identity today that just weren't possible before.
As young people become aware of their attractions, the outside world is providing more opportunities for them to understand those feelings.
We've seen Ellen on television and Will and Grace and more kinds of looking at sexual identity and gender identity in a way that's much more positive than it ever was in the past. And that's giving not only more permission, but it gives words and language to young people who didn't really have it before, access to concepts that they didn't understand. Because we're talking to younger youth who aren't acculturated yet into LGBT youth culture for the most part, they don't really use words like queer yet. But we've seen with some of our older adolescents who are acculturated, they're becoming acculturated into new concepts of language, new concepts of identity that are very different.
Young people are exploring these identity concepts, Dr. Ryan says, long before revealing them to their families. They're also plugging into communal identities by connecting with other youth like themselves. Today, they may use the internet to reach out, or they may be able to find resources in their area like a gay-straight alliance club in their school, or a gay youth hangout space like San Francisco's Lyric. Across the bay in Oakland, The SMAC Youth Center serves a mainly African-American population. SMAC stands for Sexual Minority Alliance of Alameda County.
SMAC is a good center, you know. Most of my friends is here, and, you know, it's a good atmosphere, you know, even though we have our problems every now and then, but, you know, we all work together, you know, work things out. It's a cool place, though. It's a cool family. It's a cool. They always there for me when I need them.
That's Derek, a bisexual 20-year-old from Oakland. LaDeja is 22. He identifies as gay.
You got to watch your back and you got to watch your head when, you know what I'm saying, when you out there. Because a lot of people don't like it. You know, a lot of people's not, I don't know why, you know, it shouldn't really matter what other people do. But it's a lot of people who really feel like they're being disrespected by me walking down the street and being gay. They'll throw bottles. Well, this ain't never happened to me, but they'll throw bottles, you know what I'm saying? They'll say stuff, you know, they'll cuss you out, you know, call you all kind of faggots. And, you know, so it's hard, you know, in the community. And that's why a lot of people come to places like Smack and, you know, Lyric and, you know, all that stuff. So we won't have to be around all of that.
Some young people come to Smack from fairly far away. Lil Daddy is from Vallejo, about a half hour's drive from Oakland. She's 22 and a lesbian. She says she has created a family here.
It's more like moral support. Like if you need to talk to somebody, you can talk to your gay family about whatever problems you have. Because it's like my mother, my biological mom, she'll listen, but she doesn't listen well enough to where I can talk to her about anything.
Places like Lyric and Smack, as well as websites and chat rooms, are giving young people more confidence to claim non-straight identities. Caitlin Ryan of the Family Acceptance Project.
What we found in our study is that young people don't want to keep secrets from people they care about. Young people do care about their families. Their families are really important to them, and they want to share those identities. So more and more young people are coming out. They're coming out in the context of school, you know, sophomores, freshmen in high school. They're coming out to their parents, to a grandparent, to other family members, or people who are important to them.
It's easier for some young people than for others. For Ember Cook, it's as simple as picking up the phone. She can get someone on the line who knows just what she's talking about.
Hi, my name is Ember Cook. I'm 21. I live in San Francisco, California, and I'm queer.
Hello, this is Dwight Cook.
Hi, Dad.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
That's good. So, if I remember correctly, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, when you came out to me, I think you called yourself a homosexual. That was the first thing, you know, said, I'm a homosexual.
Yeah, it was probably kind of clinical.
I know. do you remember me coming out? And how did you feel about me coming out to you?
Oh, I remember very well you coming out. you know, I think, a lot of the initial reactions that a lot of parents do. You know, I remember thinking, oh, I hope she gets over it. But, you know, I worked through it very quickly. I guess the things I struggle with today are that I still have a hard time accepting your tattoo and your piercings.
But do you remember, like, what terms I actually used?
I think you used the term gay. You know, at least what's in my mind, you probably used alternating three terms. You probably used gay, you probably used lesbian, and you probably used the fact that you have a girlfriend. You know, like girls.
Where I identify, like today, is I try and find the terms that allow the most freedom. Because, you know, lesbian, dyke, all of these terms still hold so many stereotypes and so many, like, well, if you're this, then you're this, 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 and this, and this. When I introduced myself, I said that I was queer. And how do you feel about the terms that I use, like, or in the differences between my generation and your generation?
Well, it kind of depends on the context. Queer is not my favorite word. Every time I hear the word queer, I still think that the underlying meaning there is an intent to shock. I think that's the fundamental difference between kind of how you experience it and how I experience it.
Yeah, and it was an adjustment I had to make as well. And it's interesting because it's only been through my relationships with youth my age that I've been able to see that word differently as kind of an umbrella term for all those little terms underneath, it seems like that is the term that allows the most freedom.
You know, for me, I got to a point where, you know, I took charge of who I was, and what became important was not what society offered me in terms of descriptions of myself, but what I viewed myself as and what I wanted to do. I definitely identify myself as a gay man.
Mm-hmm.
I identify myself as an American, and most importantly, I identify myself as a human being.
Rock on, Dad. Good answer. Thanks, Dad.
All right, well, I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, okay. Bye.
See you, bye.
Many young people aren't lucky enough to have such open discussions with their parents as Amber had with her dad, especially when they're outside big cities like San Francisco or New York. Amber says that if she had her way, she wouldn't label herself at all. But she admits labels do have their place.
People, of course, are constantly trying to find connections with other people. They want to find a community. They want to find links. So as scary as sometimes as it is, or confining at sometimes as it is to claim a label and to put yourself in a box, so to speak, there's also great comfort in that because you're sitting in a box with other people and you automatically have something in common, and there's power in that and there's comfort in that.
Caitlin Ryan, the San Francisco State University researcher, is excited about the future for young non-straight people.
And I think that we're going to see not only a sea change in attitudes, but we're also going to see these young people have a really important role to play in the emerging LGBT communities. If you think about the gay community, it really was a community of people in their 20s to their 40s, the pioneers who developed early community-based gay organizations. There were no seniors and there were no adolescents. And now increasingly we're learning more about our seniors who've been there all along, but they've been hidden. And we have this new group, this new cohort is the word that they use in terms of research, of young people who are coming out during adolescence just like their adolescent heterosexual peers. They are bringing new ideas. They have the potential to create great change in society. We've interviewed in our study adolescents who first identified as lesbian or gay and are now identifying as transgender. We see the whole concept of gender busting and gender change, a whole explosion of gender concepts emerging from young people.
For Making Contact, I'm Noah Miller.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. This program was produced in collaboration with Full Circle and the KPFA First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Special thanks to the Paul Robeson Fund, Shaping San Francisco, Ala Pekareva, Amelia Prather-Naiman, and William Walker. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of the program Queer Youth Identity, program number 2604, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Susanna Hines, associate manager, Rashan McKee, office manager, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host and director of production and training, Amy Pomerleau.